Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the theme of The Lynn Show, which is helping people become the person they really are and live the life they were meant to live. And then, as always, I'm going to play part of my series, Anatomy of an Artist. And today's artist is Preston Boyd, who is an actor and a musician and a teacher of theater and a director. And a person who discovered in first grade that he needn't be shy on stage. That being on stage, he could be anything. It's a delightful story and an interesting life journey. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice. Gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Show. The Lynn Show, as I said in the introduction, is all about helping people discover who they really are and live the lives they were meant to live. Fewer people than one might assume actually do that. As a therapist, I believe that most of us are living out what I call our cover story. That is a version of our real self, which is the truth, but not the whole truth. And the reason for that is that most of us have had to bury parts of ourselves in our childhood, because in some way, our childhood told us that these qualities were unacceptable. That could be our parents, our siblings, our peers, our culture, our school, our teacher. There are lots of places where we could have been told in no uncertain terms that that quality, that attribute, that behavior is unacceptable. Don't do it. And we interpret this to mean don't be it. And because we are so flexible as children, we first figure out how to pretend we're not that, and then we figure out how not to remember that we are that. We cannot amputate the that, whatever it is. We can't get rid of it. But we can forget that we have it and no longer demonstrate or express it. So we are, unfortunately, out of sync with ourselves. There are things about us which we no longer have access to. We can't use. Now, it's my belief and my experience, certainly as a therapist, that later in life, some of these qualities, the ones that we had to hide from, deny, and forget, are exactly the ones that we need in order to live the life we were meant to live. And what I mean by that is live a life that feels right, that we can do all the things that are we're capable of, that we can be content with ourselves, be all right with ourselves. And so many people are not. And that's what I mean when I say we're out of sync with ourselves. It's we don't like ourselves. We are judging ourselves. We're so many people that I treat in my practice struggle with what will people think of me if. Well, one only does that if one thinks that there's something wrong with one. Otherwise, one wouldn't worry about what others would think. And more than that, we think there's something wrong with us, we think we're going to lose friends, lovers, children, if we are our whole selves. And that's a terrible sacrifice. Living out of sync with yourself, living that you believe that there is something about you that you must hide, makes for, well, eventually depression, anxiety. Because the reality is we are who we are, whether we remember it or not. Somebody inside us knows it. And so we quite often become uncomfortable. Lots of times what I find when people come into therapy is they say, well, I want to be able to do this and I haven't been able to, or I want to stop doing that and I haven't been able to. And quite often we find that the thing they want, they already have, they just forgot it. Now, we've always had a good reason for forgetting a quality, hiding it, sacrificing it. And so it is not so simple as to say, oh yeah, that, my assertiveness, my intelligence, my joy, you know, my sense of humor. Oh yeah, right, I buried that. I've got that. I'll go get it. Well, of course, it's not that simple. The taboo against using that rises right up, smacks us in the face and says, oh no, don't do that. That's bad. That's dangerous. They won't like us. They'll throw us out. And of course, we can none of us tolerate that. So while I believe and spend my work life trying to help people remember that there are things about them that they've forgotten, and begin to get access to those things, I also know that that can be stressful, difficult, scary. And I wrote a book that talks about that. It's called When You Can, You Will. Because I don't believe that simply saying, I want to do this, okay, I'm going to do it, is enough. There is a can in there. So when you can, you will. Why you can't always do what you want to do and what to do about it. I will talk more about that in future shows, as I have talked about it in past shows. But you can learn more about that on the website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. If you go to the website, you can hear past shows. You can find out about the book. You can buy the book, actually. You can find out about therapy on the phone, which is how I do all of my practice these days. It's all on the telephone. So if you don't live in Southern Florida, where I am, you still can call me. And if you have questions about the work I do, about the book, about the shows, or comments for that matter, there's a place to contact me on the website, of course, and please feel free to contact me. Ask me any questions, make any comments. I will respond as it seems appropriate. The other thing I do in my shows is I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because our culture makes it so difficult for artists to survive that in order for someone to dedicate their life to an artist, to an art, it has to be who they really are, their real self, and the undeniable truth about them. And when you listen to people who have dedicated a life to an art, you can hear that they are in sync with themselves. You hear what it sounds like to be in sync with yourself. And it is my hope, and the reason I play these interviews, that when you hear that, you will be inspired to begin to look for what you may have denied in your life, to begin to find your whole, real, true self. And look forward to living the life you were meant to live. So today's artist is Preston Boyd. And as I have alluded to in the opening, Preston's discovery of his career began in the first grade in a very amusing and endearing way. And he not only found his path to theater, he discovered a way out of shyness. This is a lovely story. The story of a man who was lucky enough to discover so early in life his true path, the life he was meant to live. And you can hear the way it develops, and you can hear it in Preston. You can hear the way he pursued it from the moment, really, that he found it. He knew that this was where he needed to be. This was what he needed to be. This was what he needed to do. You hear it, and as I said, I hope that it triggers some reflection for you. So at the moment, as in addition to teaching theater and occasionally acting, Preston is directing, and his current directing challenge is a musical called Pump Boys and Dinettes, which is going to be playing at the Manatee Players in Bradenton, Florida. And I am going to play not only Preston's interview, but three songs from Pump Boys and Dinettes. Before I play his interview, I'm going to play a song called Highway 57, which pretty much sets the stage for the show, Pump Boys and Dinettes. And then I'm going to play a song called Pump Boys, then Preston's interview, and then we're going to go out on another song from the show. So here, before you hear from the director, is Highway 57 from Pump Boys and Dinettes.
Highway 57, the place where I was born. Right down the road a piece to the sound of a car horn. Got no use for the big town. Too many strings attached to strings. I belong to the highway and what the highway brings. Oh, yeah. Well, I run this gas station with my partner, L.M. Been 9 years together. That's him. We call ourselves the Pump Boys. L.M. and Jim. Say something, L.M.
Well, we've had our ups and downs, but it's all right working with Jim.
Come on in, Jim. What you say, L.M.?
How about some coffee? You make it so good.
Now, boys, have you been eating like you should?
Ain't been to the diner. Day or two.
You got to have your 40 kills.
That's true. Ooh,
ooh. That's fruity. And red a cup. Sisters wear the menu. Fill a man up. There's double cup diner.
Double cup.
Home cup heaven.
Sunday breakfast. 6 to 11.
Right across from the Pump Boys on Highway
tune-ups, tune-ups, gas for less. Cold beer, Gold Reefer, your choice. Your oil is fine, could you use a little moonshine? We keep America rolling, we're the Pump Boys. Oh, we're the Pump Boys from Highway 57. A little roadside gas station is what we run. Give your car a smoother ride,
a little action on the side.
Yeah. Pump Boys know how to have some fun. Cause we got tune-ups, tune-ups, gas for less. Cold beer, Gold Reef, Gold Reef, your choice. It's up to you. Your oil is fine. Good to use a little moonshine. We keep America rolling. We're the Pump Boys. We got a Tom's candy stand, peanuts and chewing gum, bananas weighed by hand, so you better watch out for my thumb. Tune-ups, tune-ups, we rejoice. Oh, we keep America rolling, we're the Pump Boys. So let's pump it up.
Oh, let's pump it up.
Oh, let's pump it up.
Oh, let's pump it up.
Drop your muffler and make some noise. Cold beer,
cold beer,
and wine,
good smoke and moonshine, we keep America rolling, we're the Pump Boys.
We keep
America rolling, we're the Pump Boys.
Cold beer,
cold beer,
and wine,
and wine,
good you,
the little moonshine, we keep America rolling, we're the Pump Boys.
So I am here with Preston Boyd in my kitchen, because he was kind enough to come down here and do this interview.
Beautiful kitchen.
Thank you very much. And I am interviewing Preston because he is directing Pump Boys and Dinettes for Manatee Players in Bradenton, Florida. And I'm about to explain to Preston that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I'm assuming, since I know that you're directing, but I've also seen you play an instrument.
Yes.
That I'm not exactly sure what the art is. Is the art theater? Is the art music? Is
okay.
The art?
Well, let's start with that, shall we?
Yeah.
I graduated from college with a degree in theater.
Okay, wait a second. You're getting ahead of me.
Okay.
It's my fault. I led you astray. Let me start here. Because we'll get to that.
Okay.
And we'll discover the art in the journey.
Okay.
Okay, I only ask one question, and that is, do you know, can you pinpoint, do you remember the very first moment that you were drawn to, curious about, either music or theater, stories, performance?
First grade.
Yeah.
I was 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And my adorable first grade teacher asked me if I would be the narrator for the story of Hansel and Gretel because she said I had such a good voice.
Oh my God.
So I was hooked.
I'll bet. What an amazing thing to tell a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
So did you? Were you?
Yes.
Were there many lines?
I had the whole show. I had to memorize all of the story of Hansel and Gretel the way her script said it would be done. It's kind of like, I think it was like Engelbert Humperdinck's opera, it only put to words. And then the other characters, Hansel, Gretel, the witch, would literally say what I said. So in the narration, I would say, and the witch said, my house is here, children, would you like to see it? And the witch would go,
my house is here, children, would you like to see it?
But literally, I sort of strung the story together, and they would pop out from behind bushes and say, oh, look, you know.
And you remembered all that?
It was pretty easy, as I recall. It was a long time ago.
but
I was hooked. I really loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked I was a very bashful kid, really bashful, and if I'm getting ahead of myself...
No, that's fine.
And the only thing that I really felt comfortable about was being in front of an audience.
Okay, so now, you were bashful at 6, but you said yes to this thing, right? Yes. And
you don't say no to your first grade teacher.
No, of course not.
You
of
just
course
don't.
Not. And was this done just in your classroom?
Yeah, it was for, well, no, it was for the school. It was for the
it
whole
was for
school.
The, for the whole
that was all. It wasn't like a community theater.
No, but the whole school was there.
Sure.
Were your parents there?
Yes.
Oh,
indeed.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
And were they proud?
Of course.
Oh, yes. Okay, good. So you're getting not only, you're getting all good here. Mm. It's all good, right? Mm. And so you come off stage, it's over, and you go back to Bashville?
Backstage? Yeah.
Really?
One-on-one, oh my goodness, I couldn't say good morning.
Really?
To somebody.
Do you think your teacher knew that? I mean, it's so interesting that she chose a bashful kid mm-hmm. to give all of this to.
Well, I've seen that in my work as a teacher. I've been a teacher for 23 years, mm-hmm. and I teach drama, and I see that quite often, that kid will come into the classroom the first couple of days, you can barely understand what they're saying, they're so shy, and then you give them a part, and it's kind of like giving them a mask, you know, they put the mask on and then they can suddenly be vibrant and funny and sad and angry, they can do all that.
So is that what happened to little Preston?
Well, I think so. If we're going to psychoanalyze me, I guess so.
Well, no, it's not that big a leap, you know. I mean, it's not
right.
not big a stretch here. So, okay, so you're 6 years old and you discover that this is something that you can do, that's a lot of fun, and that you get good stuff from it. So is there more of that in elementary school or junior high school, or do you just then fall off the radar?
No opportunity really came up until I was in junior high school, I think maybe 7th or 8th grade, around there. And the community theater where I was growing up, which was in Illinois, was producing a show in the summertime when I wasn't in school, and they needed some kids for the show. And my dad was always involved in the theater, and my dad said, well, I've got a son that's, you know, about the right age for that, so, you know, one thing leads to another. You go to the audition and get the part, and now I'm, you know, considerably older than first grade, so it's a little bit different kind of role, and involves singing as well.
Oh, my goodness,
I can sing as well. Gee, this
yes.
is great.
Wait. So your dad said, well, why don't you go down for the audition?
Mm-hmm.
And did you think okay or good or oh no? Do you remember?
You know, that's funny. It's a long time ago. I think I looked forward to it, but I was obviously scared, nervous. But remember, this is a trait that I had kind of learned about in first grade, that I like being in front of audiences.
You still
and
remember, right?
The audition, as I recall, had a lot of people in the room. This is one of the most intimidating things for people that you can think of, to be in front of strangers in a room all taking notes on
right.
notepads and looking at you, and, you know, they're literally stripping you with their eyes, and you stand up there and you go, oh, what was my first line, or what song am I going to sing, and, you know, I kind of was in my comfort zone.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
this is going to be cool.
You came alive, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't even remember what I sang for that audition, but it was in a musical, and I remember I got the part, so.
Oh, well, wait. Do you remember if you had to bring a song or whether they told you what to sing?
You know, that's a good question, because I don't think I didn't know any songs.
No, well, you just said I just realized I could sing.
I went
so.
In there and sang Happy Birthday or something
right.
like that probably, or Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, I don't know. But I knew I could sing. I mean, I wasn't like a boy soprano or anybody that was on a concert stage or anything, but I was in church choirs. I got the solos when they picked somebody out of the church choir to sing, you know, two lines or something like that. And my dad was the choir director of the church that we went to, so he was always one to say, come on, you can sing this, you can do that. And my brothers and sisters and I just got into it because of Dad, I guess.
Well, fine. But so, again, this doesn't come completely out of nowhere.
Right.
We've got the idea that performing is something to do, something
yeah.
you can do. It's not
yeah.
alien or foreign or any of that.
Yeah, and even on my mom's side of the family, her father had been in vaudeville when he was a child. And I remember Grandpa Lamb, when I was growing up, he played the banjo and he sang these corny old vaudeville tunes. And the man was 80 years old, but he was still singing these cute little vaudeville tunes and plunking his banjo. Yeah, so...
Yeah, it's in the air, and you're right. It's in the air in your family. Yeah. Okay,
both
good.
Dad and mom's side, both. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so do you remember the show, that first show in...
Sure. Finian's Rainbow.
Oh, God, I love Finian's Rainbow.
Well, then you'll love this. I had to play an African-American kid. The radio audience won't know this, but I'm Caucasian. And they were trying to get a lot of blacks in the show. They have to have a lot of African-Americans in there.
Right.
And they didn't have enough at the audition, so they decided, and this was not any longer politically correct, but at that time you could do this, get the white kids that could do the show and, whose parents were connected with the theater, and scrub them down with some black, burnt cork and stuff.
Oh,
and
my
so,
God.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you sing? Do you remember?
In the show? Great Come and Get It Day.
Oh, on that yes. Great Come and on Get It Day. On that great... I was in that show.
Oh, my goodness. Were you...
No, I wasn't.
Caucasian?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
There were a lot of black kids in my school.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, yes,
great
I remember
Come and Get It Day.
Day.
There was some place where the children got to sing some of it. And they, point to me, and it was John Henry, I think was my name, or Henry or something, and would say, the earth beneath your plow is a button, and now it's your horn,
You do remember it. Oh, my God. That's amazing. Well, all right. So that, I'm assuming, cemented it a little bit for you. That this is now the big time for you. It's not the school. There are really people are maybe paying to come to this thing. And right. Okay.
And it wasn't Hansel and Gretel.
No, and there were adults.
Grown-up theater.
Right. No. Yeah. I mean, really, you're part of an ensemble now, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. All right. So this is junior high school. So then, what happens?
Oh boy. So moving along into high school, we did have, I grew up in Illinois, by the way, and we had a really large high school there, and we had a teacher, they didn't call them drama teachers in those days, they called them speech teachers, mm-hmm. but her background was theater, and she was a dear. She loved classical theater, and she taught from the point of view of a classical theater teacher, and we all learned Shakespeare monologues and stuff, and I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, this was... in the mid-60s, a lot of turmoil in the country, political stuff going on and stuff. It was always a comfort zone there, again, mm-hmm. with the theater. People would laugh if you said something funny, and if you did want to get emotional and whatever in class, you could do that, and the kids in the class would go, wow, you almost got me crying there. You know, that was good. That was fun.
Yeah.
So that kind of segued, I suppose you could say, into the graduation year, where I went to a different high school, not the same one where my dear old sweet English teacher, speech teacher who taught drama was. In the high school I graduated from was out in Washington State. It was a much, much smaller high school, and it did not have a drama teacher. They had what too many schools have, the person who's like the low person on the totem pole, mm-hmm. who comes in from, right out of college, and they say, well, we'd like to have a drama class. You teach it.
Yeah.
But I'm a geometry teacher. That's okay.
Yeah, right.
You don't really have to know anything to teach drama.
Right.
Okay. I'm a PE teacher. That's okay. So my senior year of high school, where I really wanted to perform, there really wasn't a venue for it. But I guess I sort of became the club president. Unofficial. We didn't really have a club. But we did have some kids who liked theater and liked to act. And we would put skits together for the student council, or we would do something for the student body before homecoming or something.
Did you have like a period that you could meet?
Yeah, we did. We did. And because it was a senior, I think that was one of the privileges seniors had, was a study out period. You could either do your homework or you could get together in the lounge. We had a student lounge. And we would all, there were four or five of us, girls and boys, we'd rehearse skits or mm-hmm. scenes, and we put on a show. We said, let's do Molière, thank you very much. 17, 18-year-olds going, what should we do? Oh, let's do a Molière. All right. And it was quite successful, and I think that kind of opened the door at that high school to actually have a drama class in future years. My sister went there, who's 2 years younger than I, and by the time she was a senior, they had a drama class, and she was taking drama. So I think
you can take some responsibility for
myself and Dale and Brooke and Mike and the other ones that were kind of into it as well.
Yeah. Dale and Brooke.
Don't get started on that tribute. Okay, so then college. And I did major in theater, so we're up to where we started here, and graduated with a degree in theater arts. And
Now, this was all fine with your family, right?
Yeah. I do remember my dad at some point sitting me down and saying, it's fine, but don't try to make a living at it. And even my this grandfather who had been in vaudeville, he was in vaudeville with his sister, and she lived close by, and my dear aunt Lolita said, I was in show business for 15 years when she was just a child. She said, don't do it. Do something else. So I think I got both sides. I got encouraged, but I also got, there's a real world out there as well.
Right.
Yeah, so you always get a little bit of a safety net in college, of course, if you go to a good liberal arts school. So there were a lot of other things that I picked up along the way. And I haven't always made my living in the arts, although I would say 90% of what I have done has been arts related. So.
Well, okay, so you majored in theater.
Yeah.
And so, you have like a BA in theater, was that?
Yeah, and I also have a master's degree in theater education.
Uh-huh.
So when I went on to graduate school, it was with another thought in mind that I would also teach theater.
So,
I think that's nonsense, that old adage, them that can't do, teach.
Oh, yeah.
Them that can't teach, administrate.
Uh-huh.
I think that's nonsense.
No, I agree. I think that's just... that's a kind of sour grapes thing that people make up.
Yeah, and in fact, truly, some of the most gifted teachers are also very gifted performers, and I'm not including myself there necessarily, but I know people and my colleagues now in the business who I say are the most successful teachers really know what it's like to be in the trenches and still stay active.
You know, do you know who Austin Pendleton is?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I interviewed Austin a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And he teaches at HB Studios, where he studied with Uta Hagen, who, of course, was a brilliant actor, and taught what she knew.
Right.
Right.
And almost every teacher I know who teaches theater brings up Uta Hagen
right.
at some point.
Exactly. Right. And she spent a lot of her life teaching,
right.
which destroys that myth of, them, right? Okay. So, having said that, did you go right on to graduate school after?
No, I went. Yes and no. I went to University of Minnesota to graduate school with the hope of getting a fellowship that would lead to an apprenticeship at the Guthrie Theater.
Mm.
So when I went out there, I'd been nominated for the fellowship. I thought I had a pretty good shot at it. Didn't get the fellowship, but I was already in Minnesota. I'd been accepted into the graduate program at the University of Minnesota and was in the MFA track there. Two things happened. I met a girl,
uh-huh.
and it's cold there. And I mean, it's really cold there. So the first winter passed by, and I made it through a year of classes, and the relationship was getting heavier and stronger. And I said, listen, I'm not going to be able to go through another winter here to finish my degree. I'm moving out to California. You want to move with me? She says, no. I move out to Los Angeles. I'm going to make it big, She's still in Minneapolis. A lot of phone calls, a lot of flying back and forth. She finally says, oh, heck, I'll just go out to L.A. with you. And she actually got work almost right away there. She was more in the track of theater management, those skills, and was working.
Good for her.
Well, it was enough that we were able to get married because she had a salary. But I said, this is a good story, I said, I'm not going to marry her unless I have a job in the professional theater. And we set a date. The date was March, and it was in January when we set the date. And said, sometime between now, January and March, I have to have a job somewhere in professional theater, or we're calling this off.
Wow.
It's just a thing. So I got a Greyhound Ameripass, which allowed you to get on any Greyhound bus anywhere you want for 30 days and go around the country, and auditioned And I auditioned, and I auditioned, and I auditioned. And one of the places I came to was Sarasota, Florida. And they had this little company called Florida Studio Theater that was a semi-professional company, but they were paying actors. And they offered me a job. So when I got back to Los Angeles, I said, okay, we can get married.
So you got a job in Sarasota, Florida.
Right, at the old Florida Studio Theater when it was first starting out under the direction of John Spellman. And boy, those were the good years, I'll tell you what. My wife got a job right away at the Oslo.
Oh my.
I got this job at Florida Studio. And, you know, life was good. We were newlyweds. We had work in the theater. We didn't stay here very long. I know this is 2012 and appears to be still here, but we didn't stay here very long. We stayed for part of one season. And one of the connections that we had was through the Lort League of Resident Theaters. And one of the theaters from Baltimore, Maryland, Center Stage, saw one of the shows that we had done, and I got an offer to work at Center Stage. And so that was great because I got my equity card for that, and this was like 1976, still a pretty young guy. My wife was, again, looking to get more toward the Northeast. In that first year that we were in Baltimore, she also got her equity affiliation, so now we could work union and, you know, put some money aside and have health insurance and have kids and all the things that we wanted to do in life.
So this is interesting because this is the real thing. You guys are professional theater people now, right?
Right.
That is not that common. I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, it didn't take you very long either for the two of you to get established in the career that you wanted to be established in, essentially, and to be making enough money to begin to think about having a regular life at it.
Sure.
It's
yeah.
lovely.
Yeah.
So you said Baltimore, right?
Right.
And so what happened?
Worked for two seasons for Center Stage and then made the big jump to New York. We figured it was time and lived there for a few years. And my wife immediately got work at Manhattan Theater Club, which is quite an established theater. And I was doing some off-Broadway work, but through just doors opening, one door opens after another, got represented by a couple of different agents and was sent to do commercial, television, film, some of that stuff. Never anything really big, but again, you're putting bread on the table. And
that's right.
Got my SAG affiliation and my AFTRA affiliation. Now I have all three of the unions, so I can, I guess this kind of goes back to those roots as well. My family were big union people, politics aside, there is a lot to be said for having the care and support of a union where you can get health insurance and you can get some money put aside for a pension someday. In this period of time, we had our first child who was quite at risk when he was born, and it was kind of a neat story because we didn't think we'd be able to look at the first month of hospital bills realistically. We're going to have to find, you know, some way of dealing with this. And Actors Equity says, no, he's part of your family policy, so he's on the family insurance policy.
Wow.
We've always had that, you know, that, wow, thank you.
Yeah, really.
To look back at. And so then after a couple of years in New York, had another child along the way there, and it was... about time to make a serious decision about whether or not to stay in the city and have two little kids that were going to go to public school there, or to look at maybe doing regional theater and having a little, you know, cottage or a house or a picket fence or dogs in the yard or something like that. And through that connection from Sarasota from years back, a job opened up at the Ringling Museum of Art for me. And I said, okay, that sounds like fun. I'll be an arts administrator and don't have to worry about acting on stage or where the next part's coming along. So we moved down here, lock, stock, and barrel, two kids, me and my wife, in 82, I think it was, and I worked at the Ringling Museum for 5 or 6 years. But all that time, there was a lot of restlessness. I mean, that old Oslo Theater was right on the grounds of the Ringling Museum. And, you know, you can take the boy out of the theater, but you just can't take the theater out of the boy. So I'm looking out my window all the time from my museum job thinking, geez, I'd like to be on that stage. So in 86, 86 or 87, I'm trying to get these years right, I jumped ship and went over to the Oslo, and I did work there for a couple of years with various assignments. But one of the things I did while I was there was act in a show called Pump Boys and Dinettes,
was
produced at the Oslo in 1987 or 88. I'm trying to get these dates straight in my mind. And the show was fairly new at the time. It had been on Broadway, and it was kind of a hot ticket, and a lot of the regional theaters were picking it up. And I had a ball with it. It was just, you know, in my element. I was playing guitar, which I like to do. I was singing, which I like to do. I was acting on stage, which I like to do. And making a little money, which we all like to do. Right. So one thing leads to another, and, you know, make a long, long story short, our three-hour interview here condensed to half an hour, is I also enjoyed the idea of passing this along to other people, and maybe thinking of my grandfather and my dad and stuff, I don't know. But a job opening came up at a school and said, would you like to teach theater and music? Happened to have a little bit of chops in both areas, so I can teach a little drama, I can teach a little music up here.
And you have a degree.
And I have a degree, and I've got a master's in education, so hey, you know, let's put it all together. But I've never really left the connection with theater. Since taking this job at St. Stephen's Episcopal School is the name of the school that I teach at, since taking that job in 1990, I've done a lot of directing. I do soundtracks for music if they need, you know, guitar player, singer, or whatever. And I actually have been on stage a few times as well. I still have my equity affiliation, so I like to make sure that there's an equity contract there, but I've done that a few times since taking the teaching job as well. So there you go.
So you didn't say how you got into directing.
Got into directing by being asked to direct a show. And, I think, it was, how long ago was that? It may have been something at the Island Players on Anna Maria Island or Sarasota Players. I've directed all these places. I think Anna Maria Island was the first one. They just said, would you like to direct a show? I said, yeah, I'd like to try that. And, you know, I had class in college where I had to do that, but I hadn't really ever tried to direct actors and tell them what to do and where to go. And I also had a connection with people at Manatee Community College, and they have a wonderful theater department there. And they said, would you like to direct some shows here at Manatee Community College? And we can actually call you an adjunct instructor if you do that. Well, hey, yeah, you know, now I'm a college teacher.
Yeah,
hey,
no
hey,
kidding,
you know.
No kidding.
So I was directing shows there. That may have been the first, actually. I was thinking Anna Maria Island may have been first, but it may have been Manatee Community College back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember the show. It was The Crucible. I directed The Crucible. I loved the show. I had been in the show in Los Angeles. I loved the show and directed it at MCC. It was a good experience all the way around.
Wow. So now you have essentially the best of all possible worlds. You are able to be in the theater almost as much as you'd like. And you have this job that you like to do and are proud of, that it's making you a regular salary.
You got it.
Yes, not bad.
Yep.
Not bad at all. Okay, so I've never seen Pump Boys and don't know anything about it. Do you want to tell us something about it?
I think that's a good idea. Pump Boys and Dinettes was created by John Foley, Mark Hardwick, Deborah Monk, Cass Morgan, John Schimmel, and Jim Wan. You never see that many names on the credit line for a show.
Oh.
These six individuals were good friends. They were all living nearby each other in New York. They had several ideas for projects. They're all musicians and actors. And they came up with a series of tunes that they had written. And they're all actually successful writers as well, contributing this tune, contributing that tune, and finally, one day they said, why don't we just put all these things together under the convention of a group of people who like hanging out with each other and live nearby each other, kind of like their real life, right?
Right.
The four gentlemen became the Pump Boys, and the two ladies became the Dinettes. So they conceived this idea that there's an old gas station where the Pump Boys work, and right across the highway is
a dinette.
And the diner and the Dinettes work there. The Dinettes are two sisters whose last name happens to be Cup, C-U-P-P. So they have called it the Double Cup Diner, right? And the Pump Boys gas station is just the gas station on Highway 57. It takes place in a fictitious city in South Carolina. A lot of references to the South in here. And the plot line is just about as light and easygoing as it could be. Very sketchy plot line with a lot of songs to punctuate it. Pump Boys, when they get tired of working on cars, go over and eat some pie with the girls. The girls, when there's nobody in the diner, come over and just hang out with the Pump Boys and talk and sing songs. At one point, at the very, very end of the show, they decide they're all going to go on a vacation together. One of the jobs that's in the gas station is a Winnebago RV that needs to be fixed. So they quick fix it up, and they all pile into the RV and take
right
a test run down to Florida. And so, you know, at the very end of the show, there's like a half a page where they're in Florida, and then they come back to their Highway 57 place at the very end. It's really, it's a fun show. It's just really light.
So it's only a cast of six?
That's it, yeah.
Wow.
Four men, two women. The challenge with this show is they have to play their own instruments, and they have to act, and they have to sing, and they have to do it all on stage, and it has to all be memorized. Ordinarily, you find with most musicals, the actors will rehearse with the musical director until about the time of the final dress rehearsal. Then the orchestra comes in. The orchestra can sit in the pit. They can read the music, turn the pages as they're playing,
and
you know, all sounds so good in the end. This one, you're starting from day one rehearsing the four men, the two women, playing the instruments, singing the songs, and doing the acting.
So there's no orchestra?
Nope.
There's them.
That's it.
And what do they play?
All right. LM is one of the co-owners of the gas station, plays the piano. He traditionally is also the musical director for the show. In our production at the Manatee Players, it's Rod Dyer. Jim is the co-owner of the gas station. He's the smooth talker. He's the ladies' man kind of guy. He talks to the audience, breaks the fourth wall, does a lot of affable kind of things. Jim plays rhythm guitar, and he is, I will not give you names of actors yet because we're still casting the show. He's being played by somebody in this production at Manatee Players who has done the show before and who has played the role of Jim. His buddy is Jackson, who plays lead guitar. We have to have a firecracker guitar player here, you know, a real hot rod guitar player, and Jackson is that guy. Eddie, the other member of the band, is the silent bass player. He doesn't have any lines, but he sings and he plays bass. Okay, so we have piano, two guitars, bass, and the girls punctuate a lot of this with, if they're able to do this, with pots and pans, percussion,
yeah,
tap dancing even. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of outlets for the girls to contribute to the songs as well.
Aside from singing.
Aside from singing, right. And they do have some beautiful songs. One of the advantages you get from having six people bring the music to the table is you get different styles. And when you hear the music in the show, you think right away, oh, there's country western. Oops, wait a minute, there's swing. Oops, there's some blues. Oop, there's traditional rock and roll. And there's even a duet in Act Two that the girls do that's mildly classical. It's somewhat operatic.
Mm. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
It opens on October
25th.
We know that. Okay, the other question that I ask, although really we talk about it, that it is what we've been talking about, is you really have given a life to the theater. So just, is there anything that you want to say about what that's like?
Yeah. I don't know that I would say that I have given a life to the theater. I think I've received life from the theater. I think that Shakespeare said it best, all the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players. Every time you go through a facet of your life, open a door, see what's on the other side of the door, it is an influence of the theater. If you look at it as being a gray and cloudy day, that's how you're going to feel. But if you look at it as a day that may clear up and have some potential, you know, that's the set designer who's making it all kind of clear up at the end. And in my life, I've been very fortunate to have good things come out of situations that didn't look so good to begin with. So I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, you look at what's going to happen by the end of Act One.
You mean that because you have that perspective, the perspective that it's a journey. That's not actually what I want, but that it's a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and did you see the movie, the Marigold Hotel movie?
No, I keep hearing about it. I gotta see
it. There's a wonderful line in it that goes through it, and that it is. Hopefully, I'll get it right. Everything works out in the end, and if it hasn't worked out, it just means it's not the end.
That's great.
Isn't that great?
That really is great.
And in a way, that seems like what you're saying, because it is. Yeah. It does seem that you haven't gotten to the end yet. Yeah. That's all. It's a story, and if you're on its journey,
that's great. Yeah,
that's
absolutely great. It's profound.
I thought so too. I can't take any credit for it, but this I think is a good place to stop.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much, Preston.
So Preston says, I can't say that I have given my life to the theater. I believe the theater has given my life to me. And that, it seems to me, in addition to his perspective, which is that, you know, it could all come out right in the end, right? I think that that is the legacy of having been given so early in life the direction that was his direction. That having found, not only having found, which we can't all, you know, we can't all have first grade teachers that put us squarely on our path, but having found that, he was lucky enough to have a family that encouraged and supported him. Even when they were anxious about him, they were on his side. They allowed him to become who he is. And I'm quite sure that as a teacher and as a director, Preston gives that gift to everyone that he works with and probably everyone that he meets. Unfortunately, for so many of us, that is not a gift that we receive early in life. So many of us receive, don't do that, don't be that, don't want that, don't think that. Do this, be that, think this, act that. And so instead of being allowed to discover ourself, our path, our way, our life, we are desperately trying to walk another path, live another life, be another somebody. This is, of course, the difference between being in sync and out of sync with yourself. When you listen to Preston, you can hear the in syncness. You can hear that what you hear is what you got, you know, that you can hear that he's doing his life. I mean, even when he says, you know, I moved because it was so cold. I didn't want to be in the cold. He didn't say, oh, I should stay here even though it's cold and I should suffer because, no, he said, I don't like this. This doesn't work for me. So, it is my hope, as I said in the beginning of the show, that when you listen to someone like Preston, you hear what it sounds like to be in your own life. And that you are inspired. If you feel at all out of sync with yourself, if you are second-guessing yourself, wondering what other people are going to think about you, not doing things that you think you want to do for reasons you can't really articulate, please ask yourself, what might you have hidden? What might you have buried? And then believe me that it's still there. It may not be so easy to get back, but it's still there, and getting it back is possible. And I'll talk more about that, and as I said, you can learn more about that on the website, thelynshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And as we are closing in on the show and closing in on the song Closing Time from Pump Boys and Dinettes, I need to thank the amazing, wonderful, and without whom I couldn't do any of this, Josh Hackney, who's my IT guru and guide, and say, as I always do, if you need anything that has anything to do with computers, recording, electronics, I like to say if it has a plug, you know, or if it's digital, Josh can fix it or find out how. So if you need Josh or me, you can get us at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Click on Contact Me and say, I want Josh or I want you. And as always, I hope that you got something you could use from this show. Something you didn't know that you now know, something you knew that you forgot, something that amused you or inspired you, something that'll bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I hope you will be too.
Pull the twin garage doors down, coil the air hose tight, fill the sugars, mop the floors, leave a light on, leave on a light. Closing time, closing time, closing for the evening. I'll see you when you stop this way again. Closing time,
closing for the evening.
Closing time,
closing for the evening,
closing for the evening, see you when you stop this way again.
Knocking off, I got $22 and one dime, what'll that buy?
Hang a guess, you can pay tomorrow cause it's closing time. Closing time. When you stop this way again. Well, I'm so thankful to lighten up my load. When you abide by the roadside, it sure feels good to hit the road. Garage doors down,
closing time.
All locked up tight,
closing time.
Closing for the evening, leaving on a light till you come again.
Leaving on a light till you come again.
Leaving on a light till you come again. Yeah, leaving on a light till you come again. Leaving on a light. Good night.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I freeze? Get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't